You are listening to a Shine Light podcast production. Everyone has a Jeff Buckley story. And now your host, Jeff Haley.
All right, so I'm so excited, Christopher Searles, starting a new podcast series entitled Everyone Has a Jeff Buckley Story under the new podcast channel, Shine Light Podcast, which is going to be hosted by you, I believe.
Yeah.
So this one is going to be on the 2020 channel, but after today, the next one, which is going to be in 1 week, which is going to be Mr. Johnny Gowdy, El Rey de Podcast in Austin, Texas. We're going to have an interview with Johnny about Jeff Buckley and his Jeff Buckley story. And we're going to interview J.J. Johnson, who, you want to say who J.J. Johnson is?
Well, he's the most legit now of all of our friends of the 90s. Nice. Because he quickly went on to play with John Mayer for a few years when John was becoming the biggest star in the world. And then he was the velvet center of the, what's the right word? The velvet center of the Tedeschi.
I like the velvet
Tedeschi center. Trucks band. And one of the best shows I've ever seen. You know, it was all about JJ's snare drum. And then and now he's playing with Gary Clark Jr.
Yeah.
So it's pretty good gigs, you know, it's pretty big deal gigs. And he's not just doing them, but he's like integral to the sound in those bands. He's really a musical force in those places. So yeah, that's JJ, man. He's really, and then he's just like a special, humble human being. If he didn't ever play drums, he'd still be that person.
We're going to talk to Rachel Eckroth, who's also totally legit. David's produced her records with her and her hubs, Tim Lefevre, who played with David Bowie. But she currently plays with St. Vincent, and she was also in Rufus Wainwright's band, I believe, with Matt Johnson.
Wow. I don't know her.
She's a fantastic keyboard player.
Imagine.
I haven't spoken to her, but she says she's going to talk about a dream that she had about Jeff Buckley.
Wow.
A dream sister.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk to Jeff Lipstein, who is a New York drummer and knows an awful lot about Jeff Buckley. He's like a PhD student in Buckley. And Chris Garrigus.
Yeah, our old buddy from the small town days of Austin.
He has an infamous, famous story about Jeff Buckley.
No, I just listened to some of this stuff and I'm shook up again about his passing.
I think that's really appropriate what you just said about these feels that you have, because I think that's one of the amazing aspects of Jeff Buckley. And really this podcast is just going to be about how people, you, me, anybody else, have interacted, reacted, been impressed with. Some people have in the stories have met him, just to see, like, Jeff Buckley is a figure to people of our age group that is very significant, and those who know, and he is, those who know are willing to talk about what an amazing comet he was across the musical landscape in the 1990s. So the way this whole podcast came together was one time Conrad Meisner and I, another drummer, another friend,
went another Matt Johnson fan.
Another Matt Johnson.
All of us totally transformed by Matt's playing on that record, by the way. JJ, myself, Conrad.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, Lipstein. I mean, yeah. It was totally game-changing for drumming, what Matt did on that record for us. We were all in that school of that kind of lighter-handed area, sensitive guy drumming. And then Matt comes along and is like, oh, okay.
So we go into this bar, Conrad and I go into this bar, and we sat down, and Conrad kind of knew the bartender. She was a singer-songwriter herself. And she came up to us and she said, so what is your Jeff Buckley story? Mm. Everyone has a Jeff Buckley story. So what is your Jeff Buckley story?
I was remembering the very first time I heard any of it was I was on the road with Sarah Hickman. I'm not sure I told you this yet.
No, I don't know this.
Because I've just started kind of remembering a lot of things today, or in the last 2 hours listening to this stuff. It was 1994. I just looked at when that record came out. It was August of 94. So this was in like June of 94, maybe May or April of 94. And we were on the road with Sarah promoting her new album. And we were playing an in-store at Tower Records in DC. It was just, you know, all kind of trying to do something important in music and trying to connect to people. And then this guy hands us a cassette and we pop it in the van on the way out of DC, and feel like it only had four songs on it. And I know it was the first two, Mojo Pen and Grace. And then I think also Lover, You Should Have Come Over, and probably the single, the first single.
Last Goodbye.
Yeah, probably those four. And so, you know, the overwhelming feelings were like, wow, music just changed. You know, this is a guy who can make Freddie Mercury like fall to his knees in in absolute adoration. You know, like he's figured out how to bring together the most ecstatic kind of aspects of what we had at that moment in time kind of written off. Queen was not cool. And then Zeppelin wasn't really kind of a part of the mainstream canon, even though of course it was influential on rock and roll, but they weren't a rock band. They were like this weird, awesome for us, because we were kind of in the same, like I said, the same school. We were like these folk people, light-handed, more sensitive, lyrical poetry, people that went to college or listened to NPR or whatever, kind of musicians that, you know, had a broad background in jazz and color and texture and all this stuff. And even in the Sarah band, because Blondell was playing bass, John Blondell. And then all of a sudden that record came out and it was just like, what did we listen? You know, this is the best thing I've ever felt listening to music, and kind of ever, you know, but certainly a long time for everybody in the van at that time. And then I was kind of the baby in the band. I was probably like 22 and everybody else was 30 to 40 in the van. But, you know, we all agreed that the album, what we heard of it, was unbelievable. And we may have also just taken it off the stereo because it was so damn good that like Sarah was like, yeah, enough of that, you know.
I love that. Yeah, I love that feeling.
Yeah, it was just overwhelmingly above and beyond what we had ever heard. And then, so that's not really a great story, but like just the feelings of that. It was dark. We were driving up whatever highway out of DC, you know, through the Northeast. It was I think not raining, but that kind of after the rain thing that you have in that part of the country, which was swampy. And it was just this dramatic. It's actually, I'm in Mississippi right now, and there's a thunder in the background. So, you know, it's nighttime. Night just fell here. It was kind of like that. Night was coming down and there was this dramatic color and haze in the air while we're up on the highway and kind of going into absolute darkness, listening to these, you know, totally newfangled kind of forms of music that brought together so many passionately ecstatic kind of things, and that just had never happened before like that. You know, Nirvana was too heavy, and Guns N' Roses was too ridiculous, and Michelle Shocked was too intense or too serious or whatever. There was too much there, and somehow, and like Queen was too much of a parody of a rock band at that time. And
yeah,
so, you know, so Buckley was just some completely artistically legitimate thing. And then when the you know, when the album came out, didn't even double that. It like multiplied it by 10, you know, the song choices, the every note on every song, everybody plays on the album, just everything about it was like, if only we could be this good one day, you know, was the way I felt about it. And then maybe the last thing is like, I didn't realize it, but I was looking for some way to express and, you know, be in music that was more moving than the kind of area that jazz had moved into, because I still did kind of consider myself a jazz musician who was just working a lot with songwriters. And then I heard that record and I was like, well, this is so much more impactful as a listener from that moment in the van, you know, and this drummer is so much better than all the other drummers on the radio right now, other than maybe Dave Grohl. And, you know, this music is just so much more where I want to be in my whole world than any of what I had ever heard before from any of the people I'd listened to, any of my favorites or anything, that it from that moment in the van and that perfectly kind of darkness falling setting with a group of other people being amazed, you know, a tight shoulder to shoulder passenger van kind of thing, just like changed for life, you know, was suddenly like, oh, I see, you know, pop music can really, really deliver the impact that other forms of music absolutely cannot in this moment in time. This type of pop music is where the future is. Just now listening to those songs, it's still just kind of amazing. Matt's groove is so dead into the base of your spine. It's unlike almost anything, you know, your sacrum, I think is what it's called, the tip of your tailbone. You especially feel it on like Eternal Life, the way Andy Wallace mixes the kick drum. Mm-hmm. It's just shaking the bottom of your butt bone. You know, it's fantastic. And that's not easy to do as a drummer. That's like a timing, energetic timing thing. And so that kind of unity of energy in the music and placement and note choice and development of the thematic riff into a new kind of creative expression without ever losing the intensity of that rock and roll repetition on a perfect, you know, pattern, as it were, a perfect sing-songy thing, like a chorus, and all that stuff combining. When you listen to the record, for me, as a drummer, first of all, but also then as just a music fan, second of all, it's like every moment builds to the next moment better than any other record I know of. And so then like the solo songs, that's just another layer of why that record is so great for me, is the, you know, the set list, as it were, is more intimate than any other record. It's more on a musical level, not on a lyrical level, but just on the way that music can open up the, you know, the raw tissue inside your chest, you know, the real feelings in your heart and all that stuff that are very much physically felt. I think Buckley was kind of obsessed with the sacredness of existence in a way, and also the mystery of it, and the desire to not be afraid of what comes after this life, you know?
Yeah. Eternal life is on my trail.
Yeah. And that was present. Like you saw that when you saw him live and all kinds of things. He took a lot of chances with his life all the time, kind of trying to be fearless about it. And, you know, all that together makes then the Benjamin Britten thing, you know, in hindsight, also just this like incredibly, I mean, at the time it was like, for someone who had a musical education, as it were, because we all met in music school, you know, that was also validating and affirming, because finally there was something from the canon of basically music school, as it were, you know, Europe, that was on a rock. Yeah. That was on a rock record that kicked ass, you know, and it kicked ass because it was so beautiful and so perfectly rendered. And that was all I could ever hope to do as a musician, you know, was be good and choose well. And then there was somebody who had done the ultimate in a way in that performance. So, well, in the, so yeah, I can go on and on, but like that to me was just like another step through the line of that set list of kind of a perfect listening experience for that particular album, that particular time, you know.
In the first It's No Secret podcast, you talked about that's one of the things that attracted you to David, is the kind of the broad musical interest that he had, and how he just didn't feel like there were genres that he needed to be worried about. It's either good or bad music. At this point in the conversation, I decided to share my Jeff Buckley story with Chris, especially because Chris is such a huge part of my story. The beginning of my Jeff Buckley story,
yeah,
is when you invited me over to your house to listen to the record. Like it was going to be like this momentous unveiling of a Brave New World.
But you didn't like the record yet.
You don't think your recollection is that I didn't really like it?
Yeah, very much. I remember, you know, you kind of being like, yeah, that's cool. Yeah. You know, and like, yeah, he's really good. He's really, really good. You know, but not like in the same camp of super uber duper fan.
Yeah, well, maybe I didn't think about it, but perhaps it took me a while to warm up to it completely. I remember being a little off put with that, the middle section of So Real. The cover of the record was a little silly for my taste, but I mean, the band playing
Ruby Red Lips.
The band playing was phenomenal. Of course, it's like the bass playing is perfect from beginning to end. And as we are saying, there's something really special about Matt Johnson's playing, and Jeff's singing. That recently I watched the performance at Glastonbury they did, which I think was in, I think it was in the summer of 95. So they've been touring the record for a long time by that point. But the playing is so artistic. It's jazzy without sounding jazzy.
It's like the aesthetics of jazz without quoting anything related to jazz.
But it was, I just remember how you really were like, this is going to be the first day of the rest of your life.
Then it wasn't. But it was for me in that van.
Okay, so you were crazy about this record, as you've just said. You've just told us all that you're crazy about it. Then we actually got to open up for him at the Electric Lounge. Talked about that story.
I think you got to tell that story more than me, because I don't. All I remember is you and you missed the show because you were in the parking lot making out with your girlfriend at the time. And also that was where we were a little different at the time. I was ready to sit there and listen to Jeff. You had other priorities. You were on your own, Jeff Buckley. Your lover did come over, you know. But also that we were in a band called Earth, Pig, and Fire, I believe.
That is also that who was on the bill.
We were fun, and that we were with our best friends, and that they're both totally super talented and brilliant songwriters, and then the Buckley was wearing like a giant, floor length fake grizzly bear coat that was black or something like that, like a New York winter coat.
Yep.
And
it was in November.
June or something.
So it was in November.
It was in November, but it was hot that day. It was hot that day. It was like 87 or whatever in Austin. That I do remember. It wasn't coat weather yet.
Well, anyway, I did make a point of talking to him. It was the
most amazing show I've ever seen in my life, hands down.
I did make a point of talking to him. And so after our sound check and before we played, which was probably only like a 45-minute interval, I saw him out on the floor of the Electric Lounge, and I just like started talking to him. I know he had seen us sound checking, and I just said, "Hey, my name's Jeff." And he said, "My name's Jeff. My name is Jeff too." And Sam Weber, our friend Sam Weber, was standing right there too. I remember very well. And I just started launching into how you were telling everybody about how great he was, and how, I don't remember exactly, I either called you the Pied Piper or the John the Evangelist of Buckley in Austin, Texas.
Hey, I'll take that title now.
And
I want that Austin Chronicle Music Award for that.
Is that like
Pied Piper of Jeff Buckley?
It's a special award.
Yeah.
I guess that's a write-in. Austin Chronicle fans, please write in Chris Searles in the next
27 years later. 28 years later.
That's legit. So
you guys talked.
We talked, and he's very shy.
Yeah.
And I told him that his singing was so impressive, and apropos of music school nerdery, I told him that he had a beautiful instrument, which is that word that opera singers use for their voices, right?
Yeah.
And he was definitely flattered, and I'm sure he heard that kind of stuff a lot, but maybe not with the music school nomenclature. And we only talked for like 3 minutes, but I'm really glad that I did talk to him. And my main purpose of talking to him was to talk about what you had been doing in his name. And then I heard from Sela, because I had dinner with Sela a week ago, that you actually spoke to him in the parking lot after the show.
I have no memory of that. If I spoke to him, it would have just been like, thank you. Thank you. I don't want to bother you. Thank you. Bye.
Her story was pretty funny. Sela told me that she opened up for him in Chicago House. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So she opened up for him twice.
I forgot.
Yeah. This is important to the story, because she had been not blown away by the Chicago House performance. And she told me that she had told you that. And so then, and the parking lot afterwards, you were like saying to Jeff something like, "That was a great show. It's great to play for you or play with you, play open up for you." And you said, "This is my friend Sela." And he said, "Oh, yes, the one with the beautiful voice." And she, and that you, then you looked at her like, see?
Yeah, he's a nice guy. Yeah. Why can't we all be nice guys?
And she was embarrassed.
That kind of sounds familiar. It's funny though. I I don't know. Anyway, that's a good story.
It's a good story. I love it. So yeah, see, Misra is probably the only person outside of New York City that ever opened up for Jeff Buckley twice.
And one of the only people who Jeff Buckley said, the one with the beautiful voice. It's true about Sela. That's the thing. It's like, she ain't your average everyday good singer. She got a beautiful voice too.
Yeah, memorable. I think of her, for some reason I connect her and Sting in my mind, just because Sting's voice is so unique, and I think Sela's voice is so unique.
I bet she'd think that was hilarious.
See? Okay, so that's my Jeff Buckley story, and I'm sure that's what I told the bartender at the Cornelia Street Cafe in 2006 or whatever it was. When I moved to New York, I heard that Matt had left the band. I'm sure you're the one who told me. And I remember telling you, you should do the gig. You are the best one for this. You are the chosen one, Chris Searles.
I said, no, I wish I were. That was Matt, was the chosen one. Yeah.
Circle of life. So I saw Jeff Buckley on Lafayette Street, crossing the street towards walking. He was walking towards Tower Records. I was walking away from Tower Records. I crossed the street. I crossed him. I'm in the crosswalk. I'm thinking, do I talk to him? Do I tell him that he should hire Chris? Remember Chris, the one that played bongos at Electric Lounge?
Yes, with the kick drum.
But I didn't do it. I was too shy.
I'm glad.
And that concludes our first episode of Everyone Has a Jeff Buckley Story. We want to thank Mr. Chris Searles for being our first guest and sharing his wisdom and joy of music with us. And going forward, we're going to be on a new channel. So listen to this important announcement so you won't miss any of the upcoming episodes. Thanks, y'all. It's very important that you, the listener, go and subscribe to the new podcast channel, which is going to be called Shine Light Podcasts. It's going to be separate from the 2020 channel. New. That's where all these Jeff Buckley podcasts are going to be. Are you going to do it, Chris?
Yeah, of course. I'm a huge Jeff Haley fan also.
Yeah.
And yeah, we've talked about this a little bit. The podcasts that you've done for Twang have been very, very inventive and like interesting and actually authentically delivering the story of these artists and people and different things that have influenced our lives and kind of kept us in touch with each other. And one of the things that's kept us so close to each other through decades and long distances. So I'm excited to see what you do with a podcast channel. I've been kind of hoping this would happen for quite a while.
Well, thank you. And you've been a huge help. And everybody who listens is always so impressed with the way you speak, that you're a very intelligent person and you don't say and ah very often like the rest of us do.
Really?
Yeah. I got the tape to prove it, brother.
I got tapes to contradict that.
you've been podcasting your butt off, and your podcasts are fantastic.
And I edit out all the ums and ahs.
Snip, snip.
Truth, truth. But it's so much better. It takes tons of time, but it is so much better because it turns out I think all of us are pretty dang brilliant, and it's self-doubt and self-questioning while you're talking that makes you go, you know, and say, you know, and things like that. And when you get rid of those self-interruptions, you can hear that line of people's thinking. It's just like, dang, you know, this person is incredible. And then the next person, on and on and on. That's kind of my favorite part of the podcasting process is the cleaning up and then listening back when you can really hear people not interrupting themselves, saying exactly what they think. It's just beautiful. Kind of like the beginning of grace, you know, it just flows, unfolds.
That's the mic drop moment right there, Chris Searles.
All right.
Mic drop.